few more. Anybody else want to?
Somebody in now too.
Oh, come on, John. Again. I've seen you somewhere before. John could use a copy or share with. He's got one. But before I get started, I wanted to mention that I've noticed that the older people among us are feverishly taking notes and paying very close attention to exactly what is being said, while the younger people are biding their time, patiently listening, but not unduly stressed. And I pondered the difference between these two people and realized why the panic. They're cramming for the final exam.
Very funny.
So I want to start off. We'll start off with one of the handouts. Let's flip to the map. And actually, my topic is Abraham, Sarah, and Isaac. And because while I'm going through this, it might help to understand a little bit of the geography. And it's fairly simple. But Abraham and his family start off in Ur. And so you can see that is down near the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, near the Persian Sea. And it just struck me this morning. I want you to realize that Ur, that's not short form for universal reconciliation. And anyway, so they start off there, and he's going to make his way to the land of Canaan. But before he gets there, they go to the city called Haran. And you can see that's up closer to the sources of the Tigris and Euphrates. And don't get this confused. One of Abraham's brothers is also named Haran. So keep in mind that one is a city and one is his brother's name. And anyway, and then we're all more or less familiar with where Jerusalem is over where present-day Israel is. But Jerusalem and Hebron, and another thing, don't get Hebron mixed up with Haran. They're 500 miles apart. And then also, Beersheba is a number of miles away from there, and the Negev desert is south of there. And that's where a well is located that different people are associated with. So that gives you a bit of the geography. Now, if you flip it over, and just so we can familiarize ourselves a little bit with these names, so when I'm talking about Terah, a lot of people might go over their head, who the heck is Terah? But Terah was Abraham's father, and Terah had three sons, and I got them listed as A, B, and C. So Abram was one son, Haran, as I was saying, is another son, and Nahor was the third son. And now, Abram, even though he's often mentioned first, he's not, if you do the arithmetic, it seems that Haran is probably the oldest. And but he dies at a young age, but not before he gives, he has children himself. And his children are X, Y, Z, or Z as you would say. Iscah, Lot, and Milcah. And Milcah, marries Nahor. So Milcah is Nahor's niece. So, and they have eight sons and daughters, and two of those sons and daughters are Rebekah and Laban, who are brother and sister. Of course, Rebekah, as you know, marries Isaac, and Isaac being, the son of Abram and Sarah. And then Laban's kids, two of his kids, Leah and Rachel, marry Isaac's son, Jacob. And from them, we got the 12 tribes of Israel. So you can see it's a very tight-knit family. uncles marrying nieces, and supposedly, and in the case of Abraham, even marrying a sister. But I'm going to get into that. And you see, you know, was, we'll get into it later, but was Sarah actually his sister, or was it his niece? But we'll get into that. All right, so on to the story. So the focus of my message today is on the unhighlighted relationships between Abraham, Sarah, and Isaac. All three of them are mentioned in the Great Faith chapter of Hebrews 11, so immediately we tend to revere them. And to some degree we should, but if we look closely at their stories, we will discover the Bible never glosses over their failures and disobedience. It never paints them as anything but human. The Bible is not a book about spiritual superheroes. It is about God's faithfulness to his promises, in spite of the humans whom he chooses to use. It is God's story, not ours. So there is very little room for saints on pedestals. And so I'm going to list a number of points we may never have considered before. Now, this is not meant to degrade them, but to make them relatable to us so that we can learn from their mistakes. Now, their story usually starts off at Genesis 12:1. And I'm going to rush through this because I got a lot of material here. And so instead of waiting to look it up in everyone's Bible, I've printed out all the relevant verses there. And the version doesn't really matter much, I think, or I'm not going to get that technical. So, but I take it from kind of a literal translation. Anyway, Genesis 12:1. And Jehovah said to Abram, "Go out from your land and from your kindred and from your father's house, a land to which I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you will be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you and curse the ones despising you. And in you all families of the earth shall be blessed." And Abram went out, even as Jehovah had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was a son of 75 years when he went out from Haran. Okay, now, point number one that I want to focus in on is that family comes along. The first thing we might skim over is the instruction by God that Abram should leave his family. But have you ever considered that Lot, his nephew, went with him? And as such, Abraham was not obeying the plain command of God. In studying the Bible, we'll often find that not following the exact command of God will, sooner or later, hurt the offender. And we will see how every time Abraham did what he thought was reasonable, it made life worse for him and or those around him. Number two, Abram is in no hurry to obey. Many of us think that Abram heard the call from God while living in Ur of the Chaldeans, which was his birthplace in Mesopotamia. And being the great man of faith that he was, he immediately packed up his camels and left. But was it really like that? No, it wasn't. Let us notice what Stephen had to say in Acts 7:2. And he said, "Men, brothers, and fathers, listen. The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham, being in Mesopotamia, before he lived in Haran. And he said to him, 'Go out from your land and your kindred and come into a land which I will show you.' Then, going out from the land of the Chaldeans, he lived in Haran. And after his father died, God moved him from there into the land in which you now live." So these few verses fully explain the order in which it happened. The apparent swiftness of the events as recorded in Genesis and Hebrews might seem to contradict this, but if we look closely at them, we'll see there is no contradiction. When reading, notice the verb tense. Different versions translate slightly differently, but some of them say at Hebrews 11:8, it says, "Having been called out by faith, Abraham obeyed to go forth to a place which he was going to receive for an inheritance, and he went out not understanding where he went." And let me repeat Genesis 12, verses 1 and 4. They said, in verse 1, "Jehovah had said to Abraham, Abram. Go out from the land and from your kindred and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. And verse 4. And Abram went out, even as Jehovah had spoken to him. And Lot went with him. And Abram was a son of 75 years when he went out from Haran. And while we're at it, let's back up to the very end of Genesis chapter 11, verse 31. And Terah took Abram his son, and Lot the son of Haran his grandson, and Sarai his daughter-in-law, the wife of Abram his son, and went out from them from Ur of the Chaldeans to go to the land of Canaan. And they went to Haran, and they settled there. So to simplify this, it says, they all left Ur, Abram's father, his brothers, and their families, all of them going to the land of Canaan. But when they got to Haran, they all settled there. If you don't know where Haran is, this verse may sound like it's in Canaan, but it isn't. It's 600 miles away from Ur in modern Syria, and it's still another 500 miles from there to Jerusalem. Then finally, after many years of the family living and growing in Haran, and after Terah died, most of the family's members stayed behind. But, Genesis 12:5, finally, Abram took Sarai, his wife, Lot, his nephew, and all their possessions, and that they had gathered, and all the persons that they had acquired in Haran, and they went out to go to the land of Canaan. The point I'm making is that Abram did not start off as some kind of wonderful example of blind faith. It's going to take him a long time to get there. Point number 3. Abram, without God's instruction, decides to move to Egypt. The Bible doesn't say how long Abraham was in Canaan, but almost the very next thing recorded is that there was a famine in the land. Maybe it was a year or more. We don't know. But what does Abraham do? He does the common sense thing. He moves to Egypt where there is relief from the famine. But Yahweh had promised that he would make Abram a great nation and that anyone abusing Abram would fall under Yahweh's curse. This promise was not conditional. It did not depend on Abram's circumstances or even his obedience. It was a thing that God was doing. So a faithful Abram would have believed, should have believed, that Yahweh's promise implied provision of life in spite of any circumstances he was in. But apparently Abram believed that he had to take matters into his own hands and fix the problem. But in a minute, we will see that that puts Sarah in a very compromised position. Point number 4. The move to Egypt turns out to be unnecessary. First, let me skip ahead to the end of this famine story. Pharaoh kicks Abram and all that he has out of the country. And when he does, Abram has much more than what he arrived with. Money, livestock, and servants. Details stated are scarce. But it doesn't seem like Abram is in the land very long, and so the famine conditions couldn't have been much in the past, if indeed they were still not prevailing. And yet, nothing is said of Abram and his household suffering after they left. In fact, he had more wealth than ever. I don't know exactly what happened, but it seems God did provide for Abram abundantly, and he would never have had to go to Egypt in the first place. And number 5, Abram would not have had to compromise his marriage. But Abram did go to Egypt, and he fears for his life. His wife is beautiful and alluring. He reasons that the Pharaoh might decide to dispose of Abram to get her. So he propagates a lie. Sarah is not his wife, but his sister. This lie ensures Abram will remain alive and well, while Pharaoh gets to enjoy Sarah in his bed. In fact, Abram is lavishly rewarded for his arranging Sarah's availability. Everyone benefits, except Sarah. It is at her sexual expense. Now, I hear a lot of sermons on the faithfulness of Abraham, but none on his unfaithfulness to his wife. Is this not a most disturbing story? Abram is selfish and outright cowardly. How many men here today would sell their wives, even if to save their life? And how many wives here today would go along with their plan? And how did they think they were ever going to get back together again? How would a beautiful woman, gained at much expense, ever hope to extract herself from the harem of a pharaoh? And can you imagine the damage this did to their marriage? Apparently, Abraham was okay with another man sleeping with his wife. But how did Sarah feel? The Bible doesn't tell us. It just says she was faithful and obedient to Abram. And he had asked her even to be prepared to tell this lie, even from before they first left their homeland, if you look that up. But my guess is that she didn't like it and would not easily get over it then or later. The man you loved and had been faithful to for perhaps 40 years at this point sells you to another man for a herd of donkeys. Genesis 12:15. And the officials of Pharaoh saw her, and they praised her beauty to Pharaoh. And the woman was taken to the house of Pharaoh. And he dealt well with Abram on account of her. And he had sheep, cattle, male donkeys, male servants, female donkeys, and camels. This reminds me of a bad but perhaps appropriate joke. A husband takes his wife to a car auction. After the auction is over, a friend of the husband asks, "What did you get for your wife?" The husband answers, "A 2015 Ford F-150. "Ah," says the friend, "good trade." The Bible doesn't specifically tell us whether or not the Pharaoh slept with Sarah. But in the very next verse, after Abram collects all his donkeys, it says, Genesis 12:18, "Then Pharaoh called for Abram and said, 'What is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister, so that I took her to myself as a wife? Now then, take your wife, take her, and go.'" If Abram had only trusted God in the first place, he would not have had to put Sarah through this trauma. Number 6, bringing Lot along cost Abram the prime land. Chapter 13 starts off at verse 1. "Then Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife, and all that was with him. And Lot went with him to the Negev." Now Abram was very wealthy in livestock, in silver, in gold. We find that Abram and Lot have become so prosperous that they have to decide how to split the land up between them. Abram gave Lot the first choice as to which land he prefers, and so Lot takes the choicest land. This is cited as to how generous and gracious a man Abram was, not considering himself first, but even someone like Lot, who is in an inferior place to him in the family hierarchy. But if he would only have treated his wife Sarah so graciously. Genesis 13:10. "And Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the circuit of the Jordan, that it was well watered before Jehovah destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, even like the garden of Jehovah, like the land of Egypt as you come to Zoar." "Then Lot chose all the circuit of Jordan for himself, and Lot pulled up stakes toward the east, and they were separated, each one from his brother." This is a bit of an aside at this point. Notice here that Lot is called Abram's brother, at least in this version. The Hebrew word translated brother has a wide range of use. Many English translations don't use the word brother here because for us, in our culture, it may confuse their relationship. But in Hebrew, it was understood that it did not necessarily mean that they had the same parents. This will come up later when I wonder if Sarah was Abraham's sister. Number 7, Abram has to rescue Lot. In chapter 14, Lot gets caught up in a war and gets taken hostage along with his family and possessions. Abram mounts an army of 318 men from his own household and rescues Lot and all that was taken from him. The Bible does not tell us if or how many losses Abraham took in the battle, but one way or the other, Abram was drawn into a war because his nephew accompanied him to Canaan when God had told him to leave his family behind. Number 8, Sarah's impatience and desires. In chapter 16, after 10 years in Canaan, Sarah is now 75 years old, and I am thinking she is conflicted. No doubt she is aware of the great promises God has made to her husband about being the father of millions of descendants, but she is still barren and has given up hope of ever having a child. So she, taking a bad lesson learned from Abram, thinks she should take matters into her own hands and help God out. Perhaps she thought it was her fault that she had failed to provide Abram with an heir, and so she was willing to share him with another woman to produce it. And maybe she thought that she could treat the baby as her own and fill her own lifelong void and desire for a child through his adoption. In either event, she offers her slave Hagar as a second wife to Abram. Number 9, Abram has no scruples. I don't know if anyone asked the slave girl Hagar if she wanted to marry an 85-year-old Abram. But once again, we find that Abram has no problem with this sexual adulteration of their marriage. It worked out financially good for him in the last time. Maybe she will produce an heir, along with the benefit of being a second and much younger wife. What can go wrong? In contrast, I am reminded of the story of Samuel's father, Elkanah. He also had two wives. One of them had sons and daughters, but Hannah, his first and favorite, had none. And when she would weep because she had no children, it says in 1 Samuel 1:8, Elkanah, her husband, would say to her, "Hannah, why do you weep and why do you not eat? And why are you heartsick? Am I not better to you than 10 sons?" If only Abram had had this much devotion for 75-year-old Sarah, he could have prevented a lot of heartache. But instead, Abram, with no apparent argument, got into bed with this much younger virgin and quickly produced a pregnancy which just as quickly produced conflict in the now complicated family. Number 10, this leads to Hagar's disrespect for Sarah. Hagar, an Egyptian slave, who we don't know, but may have been a gift to Sarah from Pharaoh, is now pregnant. Immediately, she seizes on the opportunity of her newfound elevated position and becomes disrespectful of Sarah, which of course upsets Sarah so much that, number 11, Sarah becomes vindictive. But this time, Sarah has had enough of being walked over, and she is not going to be abused, especially by a slave. We find that Genesis 16:5, and Sarah said to Abram, "My injury be upon you. I gave my slave girl into your bosom, and she saw that she had conceived, and I was despised in her eyes. Let Jehovah judge between me and you." Now, exactly what she meant by this and who she is blaming, I'm not quite sure. But she is very upset with the whole situation. And as a result, number 12, Abram is caught between the two wives. As a result of Abram's unfaithfulness, he has got himself into a no-win situation. He throws up his hands and tells Sarah to do whatever she wants with her. So Sarah is now going to get a little revenge on both Abram and Hagar. 13. Abram allows Sarah to abuse Hagar. Sarah abuses Abraham's second wife so badly that she runs away. Now, escaping might have been one solution to everyone's problems, but God is not going to let any of them off the hook. All three of them are going to have to live with the consequences of their actions. An angel finds Hagar in the wilderness and orders her to go back to Sarah and submit to her. Ishmael is born, and we can only imagine how the next 15 years continues to be strained for everyone. Next, in chapter 17, 13 years later, God appears again to 99-year-old Abram. God changes his name to Abraham and initiates the circumcision covenant and promises the birth of Isaac through Sarai, whose name is now changed to Sarah. Number 14, God makes a great promise to Sarah, but Abraham still seems oblivious to her, even though God refers to Sarah five times in the first verse, reading here from Genesis 17, 16. God says, "And I have blessed her and have given also to you a son from her. Yea, I have blessed her, and she shall become nations. Kings of people shall be from her." And Abram fell on his face and laughed. And he said in his heart, "Shall one be born to a son of 100 years? And shall Sarah bear a daughter of 90 years? And Abraham said to God, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before you." Instead of being overwhelmed with faith in God and joy for Sarah, Abraham laughs and says, in effect, "Don't worry about Sarah having a baby she has wept for all her life. She'll get over it. I am happy with Ishmael. Make him my heir, and I'll be happy." But God said, "No, this is not what will be. That is not what will be. I will tell you what will be." Once again, note this for a little later. Most versions say Sarah was 90 years old, but literally it says she was 90 years a daughter. The point being, these family terms such as daughter and sister have a wide-ranging usage. Number 15, Abraham obeys. To me, this seems like the first time Abraham immediately obeys on a major issue. He had himself and every male in his household circumcised that very same day. Number 16, Abraham cares for the righteous. In chapter 18, we see a benevolent side of Abraham. We don't know why he cares so much for the citizens of Sodom and Gomorrah, unless it is, again, just for the benefit of his nephew Lot and Lot's family. But he argues with God against destroying the cities for the sake of 10 righteous men. It is gratifying to see him this passionate, but again, it's hard for me to understand this in the light of his careless approach to Sarah. He never appealed to God to protect her in Egypt or begged that she might have a baby. 17, the sister deception again. In chapter 18, God appears and specifically promises that Sarah will have their son the next year. But unbelievably, in chapter 20, Abraham's disregard for her continues. They travel to Gerar, where once again, to protect his own hide, he tells the king Sarah is his sister. After all they have been through and all that God has promised and done for Abraham, he still feels he has to lie about Sarah. Last time with Pharaoh, we were left wondering if she ever slept with him or not. But this time there is no doubt that she did not. Once again, against all logic, Abraham profits at the expense of Sarah. After God threatens to kill Abimelech if he touches Sarah, Abimelech gives Abraham 1,000 pieces of silver to ask God to forgive him. I would think it should have been the other way around, and Sarah should have given Abraham a good slap. But obviously, my thinking is not God's thinking. Number 18. So, was Sarah Abraham's half-sister? Let me diverge here and speculate a little. but with evidence. Abraham told Abimelech that he and Sarah had the same father, but not the same mother. This story is happening about 400 years before Moses gave the law that a man is not permitted to marry his sister, that being either his father's or his mother's daughter. See Leviticus 20:17 about that. It's not on your sheet. Now, so either this law was not in effect, or if it was in effect, Sarah could not have been, according to God's law, his sister. Meaning either she could be the daughter, as we understand the word daughter, of Abraham's father. In English, we understand a sister as being an immediate sibling, and a daughter as being an immediate offspring of a parent. But such was not the case in Hebrew. It could be used in a more general and wide-ranging sense. In other words, a niece, aunt, and cousin could also properly be called a sister. And so there is room to believe that Sarah could actually be Abram's niece, which would not violate God's law as found in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. If we refer to their family tree, which you have in front of you, we will see that Lot is the only son of Haran. And maybe because of Haran's premature death in Ur, Abram wanted to stay close to Lot and his sisters. And this helps explain why he did not suddenly leave them in Ur when God first appeared to him, and why, much later, when he did leave from Haran, he took Lot under his wing. Lot, his nephew, did not have a father, and Abram did not have a son. They each filled each other's void. Abram's brother Nahor may have had a similar sympathy for his brother's fatherless girls. You see, Haran had two girls and a son. And what does Nahor do? He marries one of them, and we are told that they had eight children. One of those boys eventually fathered Laban and his sister Rebekah. Now, so far, this is all straightforward. But there could be one other mystery going on here. There is one more uncle, who is Abram, and there is one more unmarried niece, named Iscah. Is it possible that she is also known as Sarai, and Abraham married her? Now, there are a few reasons why this might be true. Number one, I would never rely exclusively on the Talmud. It says a lot of stupid things, but it does say a lot of good things, you know. But it says that this woman named Iscah is also Sarah. So, for whatever that is worth, that is point one. Number two, the Bible does not otherwise tell us who Iscah married. If you look at the chart, there's nothing beneath her. Or who her descendants were. It tells us all about the descendants of her brother, Lot, and sister, but nothing about her. Now, speaking from silence doesn't prove anything. But why are we told absolutely nothing about her? Perhaps we are supposed to fill in the blank here. Number three, chapter 11 tells us who the children of Nahor are. Chapter 11 tells us who the children of Terah are. It lists Abram, Nahor, and Haran, but it doesn't tell us he has any daughters at all. If we read this chapter, it lists in very short order the previous eight generations of Terah, going all the way back to Shem. And there is a formula repeated eight consecutive times. It says how old the patriarch was when he died, and then it says, and he fathered sons and daughters. Eight times this is repeated, but when it comes to Terah, it says he had three sons, period. The absence of the statement is glaring if he had any daughters. Two of Terah's three sons had daughters, and it mentions them even by name, as we can see on the chart. So why is it not made plain to us if Terah had any daughters? Why is it that the only way we know that he supposedly had a daughter was through Abram and through his deceitful story? Number four, and yet, just a few verses later, it actually does tell us exactly what Terah's relationship is to Sarah. It says she is his daughter-in-law. That is the only way she is described to us as related to Terah. In a weird way, it would be technically true that she could be both, if Terah's son and daughter married each other. But by the same reasoning, he should have called Abram not his son, but his son-in-law. Wouldn't that be strange? Number five, it was extremely important that all the patriarch's wives were blood-related. Isaac and Jacob married their cousins from Haran, and Esau was cut off because he didn't. Two of Judah's children by a Hittite woman were killed by God, but we are not told where Sarah came from. It just makes sense to me that she is a relative, but not his sister, but his niece. Number six, and this could be yet another reason why Abram was so slow to leave his brother's families. Sarah was from that family. She didn't want to leave her family behind. But having said all that, I have to admit that the awkward and wordy verse 29 does seem to distinguish between Sarai and Issachar as being two separate people. And so that would have to be explained. But so would everything else have to be explained that I just went over. Okay, leaving that behind, number 19. Sarah makes an evil demand. Hagar and Ishmael are expelled, and Abraham is distressed. In chapter 21, Isaac, the promised son, is finally born. When Isaac is weaned, Abraham throws a celebration. In the middle of it, Ishmael does something to Isaac. Different versions say he was either mocking, playing with, sporting with, making fun of, or laughing at Isaac. We're not quite sure, but whatever it was the straw that broke the camel's back. It outraged Sarah enough that she demanded that this slave woman and her son be thrown out of the house. She had lived in this dysfunctional household for 15 years and now didn't care anything about their survival or the feelings of Abraham. But Abraham is shocked. Genesis 21:11. And the thing was very evil in the eyes of Abraham on account of his son. But Sarah had had enough of catering to Abraham's wants. She didn't care how much he loved Ishmael, his firstborn son, and whom he had treasured for 15 years. He and his slave mother must now be cast out, and he, Abraham, was going to do it and do it now. Abraham's unfaithfulness to God and Sarah and the willingness to go along with Sarah's plan to have a child through Hagar was now coming back to haunt him in the most painful way. He had to make a life and death decision between his two wives and his two sons. There was no good solution. But fortunately for him, God intervened and told him what to do. Verse 12 says, and God said to Abraham, let not be evil in your eyes because of the boy and on account of your slave girl. All that Sarah says to you, listen to her voice, for in Isaac your seed shall be called. Genesis 21:13. And also I will make a nation of the son of the slave girl, for he is your seed. So, with at least some relief, Abraham packed them off the next morning. They almost died on their journey, but God intervened and they survived. But once again, can we imagine the strain that this event put on the relationship between Abraham and Sarah? How did Abraham feel towards Sarah and her evil demand? Would their love for each other ever be the same? And for that matter, at this point, how much did they really love each other? Number 20, the binding of Isaac. Abraham is finally and fully faithful. 22:1, and it happened after these things, testing Abraham, God said to him, Abraham, and he said, behold, and he said, now take your son, Isaac, your only one whom you love, and go into the land of Moriah, and there offer him for a burnt offering on one of the mountains which I will say to you. And Abram started up early in the morning and saddled his ass, and he took two of his youths with him and his son Isaac. And he split wood for a burnt offering and rose up and went to the place which God had said to him. The text that we have says very little. God asked Abraham to sacrifice his son, and surprisingly, there is no verbal response whatsoever recorded in the Bible. Abraham simply obeys and gets up the next morning to do the deed. We can tell that Isaac did not know what the plan was, and he was not told what the plan was. And we can imagine that Abraham certainly did not consult Sarah. Isaac is probably her whole world. I imagine he meant more to her than Abraham. And Abraham probably felt the same way. But it now seems that Abraham has finally gotten to that point where he has absolute faith in God. We can surmise this when he says to the two young men who accompanied them up to the base of the mountain, Genesis 22:5, you stay here with the ass. I and the boy will go over there that we may worship and may return to you. Number 21, but his faith cost him his family. As we know, Isaac was not sacrificed, and they did return together. Or did they? Here is a surprising fact that is easily overlooked. In two separate verses, the Bible tells us they went up together. Genesis 22:6. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on his son Isaac, and he took the fire and the knife in his hand, and the two went together. Verse 8. And Abraham said, my son, God will see to the lamb for himself, for a burnt offering. And the two of them went together. There doesn't seem to be a particular need to state this twice in three sentences. Shouldn't it be obvious that the two went together? But this then highlights a contrast that we find just 11 verses later, where it says at Genesis 22:19, and Abram returned to his young men. Notice it doesn't say, as the other verses said, and the two of them returned together. But it's not hard to imagine why. I think it's because Isaac took off in a flight of panic. Number 22, is Isaac a type of Christ? It is said both were conceived under impossible circumstances. Both were the only sons of their father. Both carried wood up a mountain. Both were a willing sacrifice to God. Both were innocent. Both were sacrificed and came back to life. Now, I do understand that there are parallels, but we shouldn't carry them too far. Isaac's birth was miraculous, but it was not a virgin birth, and he really wasn't the only son of his father. And Isaac may have been young and innocent, but he probably wasn't sinless. As he actually wasn't sacrificed, he didn't really take the same place as Jesus. And he didn't even take the place of the ram. He wasn't resurrected to a new life, and I don't even think he was a willing sacrifice. Genesis 22:9. And they came to the place which God had said to him, and Abraham built there the altar, arranged the wood, and he bound his son Isaac, and laid him on the altar, on the wood. If he was a willing sacrifice, what was the point of Abraham binding him? Number 23, Isaac feared God, and not in a good way. Can you imagine the trauma you would feel if you were an unwilling sacrifice? Your dear father, whom you had trusted and loved all your life, suddenly comes up from behind you and either knocks you out or overpowers you and binds you up. Then he places you on a heap of wood with a knife and a fiery torch beside him on the ground, ready to slit your throat and burn your dead corpse. As Isaac sees his father reach for and grab the knife, he must have gone into an absolute state of terror, for he had witnessed many rams slaughtered and burned before him. Would you agree fear and dread seized Isaac? Now, by the time we get to Genesis 31, the storyline has changed, and it is all about Jacob. And in the context is about him arguing with his father-in-law. But regardless, Jacob twice uses a very curious title for God. He calls God the fear of Isaac. Genesis 31:42. Except the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had been for me, truly now you would have sent me away empty. Genesis 31:53. The God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, the God of their father, let judge between us. And Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Biblical commentators struggle to explain this title. But if Isaac was a surprised and unwilling sacrifice, then it would not be so curious at all for God to be called the fear of Isaac. Strong's definition of the Hebrew word used here begins with alarm and continues with dread, fear, and terror. No doubt Isaac had told his son about his horrific experience at the hands of his father, Abraham. And now in this chapter, Jacob is making an oath while he is very upset and angry, and he is proclaiming that the terror of his father's God should be upon whomever should break that covenant. By the way, I have a suggestion to impart to everyone at this point. If you have a family Bible study, I would strongly suggest that you don't study this story before you tell the family, let's go on a summer camping trip this summer. The next chapter, 23, tells us about the death of Sarah. Genesis 23:1. And the life of Sarah was 127 years. And Sarah died in Kir Jathar Ba, it is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. And Abram rose up from before his dead and spoke to the sons of Heth, saying, Genesis 23:4. I am an alien and a visitor with you. Give me a possession among you so that I may bury my dead from before my eyes. Sarah is the only woman in the Bible whose age at death is given. Note that it says she died in Hebron, and Abram went there to mourn for her, and he called himself an alien there and requested permission to buy a grave for her there. What does this indicate? Where was Abraham living at this time? Let's look at the previous two chapters. And three times it tells us Abraham was living in Beersheba. Dealing with the expelling of Ishmael, it says in 21:14, and Abram started up early in the morning and took bread and a skin of water and gave them to Hagar. And she left and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. a treaty with Abimelech says, 21:32, and they cut a covenant in Beersheba. And he, Abraham, planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba. And there he called on the name of Jehovah, the everlasting God. And Abraham lived in the land of the Philistines many days. And then, third example, after the binding of Isaac, he went down the mountain alone at 22:19. And it says, and Abraham returned to his young men. They rose up and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham lived at Beersheba. So we see confirmed that for a long time, before the binding, during it, and after, Abraham lived at Beersheba. But when Sarah died, she died in Hebron, which is about 35 miles away. Now we can speculate all day as to why she died there. She could have been there visiting one day and died. But I think after she found out from Isaac about his near sacrifice, neither of them would take any more chances with his life, and they left Abraham. The man she had selfishly been obedient to all of her life was willing to kill the son she had longed for 90 years. It was just too much for her. But I must also note that Abraham wept for her, a strong emotion we have not seen from him displayed toward Sarah. Perhaps he was weeping with love and regret. Number 25. There's indication that Isaac left home as well. In chapter 24, Abraham is arranging for the marriage of Isaac with his servant. We may notice that Isaac is absent from any of the conversations. Now, that's not proof that he wasn't living with Abraham, but there are more indications to come. Abraham sends his servant back to Haran to find a relative and suitable wife. And he tells the servant that under no condition to allow Isaac to return to the old homeland. This seems an indication that Isaac was not living where Abraham has any direct control over him. Further, when the servant returns with a bride for Isaac, Abraham is not in the picture. We are told Isaac is living somewhere else in the Negev and in the same place where Hagar had encountered God. Genesis 24:62. And Isaac had come from the gate of the well of the living one, my beholder. That's the translation of the Hebrew word. And he was dwelling in the land of the Negev. And he raised his eyes and looked, and behold, camels were coming. And Rebekah lifted her eyes, and she saw Isaac. Verse 67. And Isaac brought her into the tent of his mother Sarah. And he took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. And Isaac was comforted after his mother. This well may not be too far from where Abraham was living, but regardless, it was not the same place. It says Isaac took his bride into his mother's tent and loved her. This indicates Sarah was not living with Abraham. She had her own tent, which was now in the possession of Isaac. It's confusing, but it seems they were living perhaps even in three different places: Hebron, Beersheba, and the Negev. It is implied Isaac and Sarah were very close, as Isaac deeply missed his mother since her death, but was now comforted by the love of a woman again. No mention of Abraham is made. If Abraham had been in the picture, I am sure he would have spent a fortune on a huge celebration, you know, of the wedding. But such was not. His wedding amounted to absolutely nothing but their quiet, joyful meeting and private union. The next chapter tells of Abraham's marriage to and children by Keturah and other concubines. The Bible doesn't plainly record a reconciliation between Abraham and Isaac, and neither does it describe a final hands-on blessing. But it does say this: at some point, Genesis 25:5, and Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac. And, verse 8, Abraham expired and died at a good old age, aged and satisfied, and was gathered to his people. And his son Isaac and Ishmael buried him at the cave at Machpelah. In conclusion, I don't think we realize enough that the patriarchs lived through painful relationships similar to us. And although we like to read Cinderella stories where everything works out perfectly in the end, such is too often not the case when it comes to real life. And that is exactly what the Bible is all about. Abraham turned out to be a man of great faith, but it took him most of his life to get there. And the mistakes he made along the way were never magically erased, but stayed with him the rest of his life. It seems such a shame, but when he finally got to the point of putting his absolute full faith in God and was willing to sacrifice Isaac, fully believing that God would restore Isaac back to him, Isaac and Sarah were not at the same place in their faith. It's a sad way to end the message, but the lesson is to be faithful and obedient to God right from the beginning. Don't try to think you can help God out by doing it your way, or that God's ways don't apply anymore. We can be assured that God will always forgive us, but that doesn't mean he is going to undo the damage that we have done to ourselves and to our loved ones. I pray that we learn from Abraham and prevent a lifetime of regret. Amen.
Amen. Amen. Hey, it's quarter after 10. We'll get started.
How long was that?
Good.